War and conflict have disastrous and long-term impacts on local communities, but the effects are felt throughout the world, including diaspora communities. Research shows the mental health impact of global catastrophic events on the diaspora, and also the push-pull impact on local people of global events. Researchers claim migrant groups should not be seen as isolated from their country of origin. Instead, they are subject to global influence over their personal and social lives. I spoke with Professor of Mental Health at the University of South Australia, Nicholas Proctor, and a diaspora Afghan researcher, a PhD candidate at the University of Queensland and teacher at the Southern Cross University, Mujib Abid, to find out about the impacts of war on diaspora communities, particularly the Ukrainian and Afghan communities.
Nicholas, how does war and conflict overseas impact diasporic communities?
Look, this is a big area. The impact can be a bit like a push-pull effect. On the one hand, you feel that you really want to know what's going on, and you may have loved ones, family, friends who are caught up in difficult circumstances, so you want to be able to see that. And at another level, it's catastrophic because the way in which people lose touch with family, worry about family, are preoccupied by the well-being of family and friends, but also seeing the images of their homeland, the people and places where they have shared cultural links, be destroyed. So physically people are here, but emotionally they're over there.
And could you explain a little bit about, in your research you mentioned that people in diaspora communities, they're not isolated from their country of origin, they're largely connected, that they are connected to global dynamics. Could you explain a little bit more about this?
Yeah, look, this is a very interesting area. We might think that we're physically here, we're in Brisbane or Melbourne or Adelaide, wherever we may be, or Port Augusta for that matter. But we identify completely with situations, and in the case of war, it's pain and anguish that we see and hear. Our lives are interrupted, so we have a preoccupation about what's going on, but also time zones are different. And, you know, this is the kind of community reality for a lot of people. And this impacts the global influences, impact on personal and social life. And for me, it's about mental health and well-being. So looking at these impacts on mental health and well-being, going to work, making decisions, getting children ready for school in the morning, getting a good night's sleep. There's a whole range of collateral effects, if you like, which come out of these difficult circumstances.
And about the mental well-being, what communities do you focus on your research?
Look, I first started looking at this phenomenon back in 1991. Between 1991 and 2000, there was a catastrophic war in the heart of Europe, in the former Yugoslavia, and countries that made up, the nations, the states, if you like, that made up the former Yugoslavia. And I came up with the term, I coined the term long-distance suffering and devastation. So people, as I say, are physically and emotionally here in Australia, but they're also emotionally over there. And back then in that particular conflict in Europe, people with ancestral links to that region living in Australia reported that they couldn't watch television. The coverage made them, in some cases, physically unwell. And their experiences fluctuated in response to good and bad news about homeland events. So people working in healthcare, people working as GPs, people working in frontline work were reporting a shift in the change of well-being and mental health amongst their patients. And the shifts were unbearable sense of fear, sleeplessness, irritability, inability to concentrate, feelings of frustration, loneliness, sadness, a whole range of emotions that came and went in waves. So we have seen this in more recent conflicts. So if we think about Ukraine, we've got a really important connection here where people are re-triggered by these events. And these kinds of connections are really important. If we're going to be able to respond with compassion, with support, and be trauma aware, we've got to be aware of distress triggers. So that's my main focus, and that really started back in the 1990s.
How do people, diasporic communities, they manage the interplay between the events that happen in the homeland, the reports that they're hearing on the media, their cultural identities, and the mental health in Australia?
Look, it's very complex, and there are differences within groups. For some, it's about moderating or calibrating television exposure, news exposure, maybe not looking at the internet late at night just before it's bedtime, or not going onto devices to find out what's going on. But at the same time, finding a way to be able to keep up to date. So trusted sources, trusted reliable sources of information are often considered to be important. These are really important things. And of course, lifestyle changes as well. It's making sure that people make time to connect with children and loved ones. There's a lot to think about, and, you know, there's a lot to do for yourself, but also to be mindful in supporting others.
And now, how should people respond and support others who have been through traumatic experience and then get re-triggered?
Yeah, so re-triggering is a really interesting area. And at an individual level, what I'm finding to be very helpful, and what people say is very helpful, is to be really aware of what's going on within yourself. So identifying your own distress triggers. And if you're supporting somebody, look, I say work to a situation where the person feels listened to, understood, and validated. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean giving advice or having answers for people, but listen to listen rather than listen to reply or listen to respond. Look, mindfulness-based activity is often recognized to be a helpful intervention for anxious feelings or anxious states, and seeking out the company of trusted others. I use the term trusted others in a specific way. They're people that you like to be with and they like to be with you. But the company of others would include conversation about non-war topics, so things that aren't really directly related, but they distract and they create a different sort of headspace. And finally, working towards getting a good night's sleep and, you know, doing things that promote sleep. Think about the room, think about limiting devices, and maybe limiting conversation. Maybe listening to relaxing music before you go to sleep. So these are some supportive ideas, and keeping connected, socially connected with people.
What do you think, what role the government needs to play to address this issue?
Look, I think the government has a great opportunity for co-design, community-based, community-led driven support. So communities know what they need. So if we look at more recent conflicts and upheavals and catastrophic events from places like Afghanistan, for example, there are many people in the communities that come from Afghanistan. They know their area well, they know their people well, and they can make, you know, practical inroads. Governments can listen to practical suggestions to support people who are impacted. Giving power back to communities is an important way to support communities. Before things become too difficult or excruciating. Community-based solutions, coming together, being with people, having human connection with another person that you like being with and that you trust is incredibly powerful.
You're listening to The Wire, independent news and current affairs broadcasted on community stations all around Australia. That was Nicholas Proctor, Professor of Mental Health at the University of South Australia, speaking to me about diaspora community experiences being torn between worlds, specifically the experiences of Ukrainian Australians. I also spoke with an Afghan diaspora researcher, Mr. Mujib Abid, about the impacts of the war and the Taliban overtaking on Afghan Australians to find parallels in diasporic experiences.
Our experiences are painted by the fluctuations, the ins and outs, the sort of upheaval that comes with armed conflict. And this is certainly the case with the Afghan community, whether it's the way that Afghans relate with one another, whether the perceptions of different and by the same token of sameness, whether it is our own sort of psychosocial individualized experiences on a daily basis, they're all quite closely tied to life back home. Our now, our present sort of experiences are really closely intertwined with out there.
Similar to the phenomenon Mr. Proctor mentioned about community reality for Ukrainian Australians and the concept of long-distance suffering, Mujib says the Afghan diasporic experiences is painted by dynamics abroad, but also influenced by national dynamics and policies from the Australian government.
Our diasporic experiences here, as much as I say, it is painted directly and indirectly by what's happening back there. It's obviously our lived reality isn't Brisbane, isn't Sydney, isn't Melbourne, right? Like, this is where we wake up in the morning, go to work, go to school, whatever. So in many ways, what we do here, especially this goes to institutional power and you know, people who make policies and people who, you know, are in positions of power here in Australia, they really play an important role as well in painting our lives for us. So it's just that it kind of goes both ways, and the attitudes here in Australia, I hope over time, would change, and that it would be a little easier for people who might look different and be of a culturally different background or of a different heritage to be themselves, to be more comfortable in their own skins.
I wanted to ask you, Majeeb, so, you know, what is your own experiences following the Taliban overtaking in August 2021? What impacts did you see yourself and within your family?
Well, look, I mean, there's obviously the sort of visceral experiences that I go through. Despair, the sense of despair one has to sort of reckon with, because the country is on such a cynical trajectory, for lack of a better term. So obviously that is something that then kind of bleeds into my work, my political life, my activist life, community engagement. It's sort of how I feel about and back home, and how I'm trying to sort of contribute towards dialogues and conversations that might be a part of the forces that is needed for a change of course or a pivot in the direction. On the other hand, sort of increasingly seeing how people within my own orbit, within our family, increasingly find themselves in need of a job, lacking employment, ruptures and disruptions to their lives as it used to be. Not that it was perfect by any stretch of the imagination under the Republic during the times of the American occupation, a very violent and rather sad politics back then as well. So this is by no way romanticizing what was, but certainly what is right now is forcing us to take on the responsibility of, you know, sending back whatever aid and support we can in our individual capacity. So remittances have increased. We feel the need to do more, and certainly more people, more of our friends and families reach out for help and assistance. So just some of the sort of new changes that defines this new reality for us.
Absolutely. And how do you think people manage, or yourself as well, as an Afghan, manage the interplay between, you know, events that happen in Afghanistan, the media reports that you hear, your cultural identity and mental health?
Okay, it's a difficult one, because, I mean, the Afghan culture, I can speak to that one more confidently, you know, when it comes to mental health, when it comes to asking for intervention and support from the sort of right people, from the trained professionals. Seems like it's all of it is quite new to us, or for many of us, entirely unfamiliar frames of reference and categories. Certainly the conflict, protracted conflict, hasn't helped, but culturally as well, more masculine society like Afghanistan, but all of those coming together makes it difficult for people to reach out. What I do at in my capacity in the community, I try to normalize some of these conversations and hopefully do away with some of the stigmas. But I know, as I say, that I need a lot of help, and it's not going to be an easy task.
Mujib says standing beside diaspora Afghan and other diasporan communities, those with lived experiences, is incredibly important in creating social change.
I have a line that I seem to be parroting for a while now. And that is this: if you have reason to believe that you can help, if you have reason to believe that you can be an agent of change for the Afghan community, or really diaspora communities in general, do it while standing next to someone who is from that community. I think it's incredibly important to have the input of people from the communities with lived experience to guide our hands, to advise us, for us to consult with them. Really well-meaning people can make some really rookie mistakes that then can have repercussions, sometimes very serious repercussions, that can lead to re-traumatizing people that was never intended, but nonetheless is an outcome of our intervention.
Absolutely. So the main message there really is for broader community to stand in solidarity with Afghans and to help in a way that supports and empowers Afghan communities, as opposed to, you know, saving or having a problematic way of approaching aid and support. So I think that's a really important message. That was Mujib Abid, a diaspora Afghan researcher, a PhD candidate at the University of Queensland and teacher at the Southern Cross University, ending my report about the impacts of conflict and war on the Afghan diaspora community.